Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be taking a look at Fincher's first theatrical film, Alien 3. And for that, we'll just do a little bit of feedback. I just wanted to briefly thank some folks who retweeted my Back to the Future podcast on Twitter. Hedge Knight, Space Cowboy Sci-Fi, and Scott Merrihew. Thanks, guys, for retweeting me. Appreciate it. And now, so let me talk about some background for Alien 3. With the success of Aliens, Fox approached Brandywine Productions for further sequels. Brandywine Productions was not enthusiastic about an Alien 3 project. David Giler was talking about him and Walter Hill and Gordon Carroll. You know, they didn't know where to go after 1 and 2. They thought, you know, what are we going to do? You know, money is money. Various concepts were discussed, and they eventually settled on a two-part story. With a treatment for the third film featuring the underhanded Weyland-Yutani Corporation facing off with a militarily aggressive culture of humans whose rigid socialist ideology has caused them to separate from Earth's society, end quote. Wow. Michael Biehn's Corporal Hicks would have been promoted to the protagonist in this third film, and Ripley would have been reduced to basically a cameo before returning for the fourth installment, quote, an epic battle with alien warriors mass-produced by the expatriated Earthlings, end quote. So Sigourney Weaver liked the Cold War metaphor and agreed to a smaller role in the third film because she wasn't too happy with Fox removing part of Ripley's backstory in Aliens that she considered crucial. So she was kind of supposedly a little cold towards Fox and didn't mind doing a cameo in 3. So Fox was skeptical about the idea, but they agreed to finance it. They asked that Hill and Giler try to get Ridley Scott to make Alien 3, and they also asked that the two films be shot back-to-back to drop production costs. And Scott was interested in returning. He had big-time scheduling problems. He was quite the guy back then and couldn't do it. So in September 87, Giler and Hill approached cyberpunk author William Gibson to write the script for Alien 3. Gibson, who told the producers his writing was influenced by Alien, which I didn't know, which is kind of cool, accepted the task. So he drew heavily from Giler and Hill's treatment, having a strong interest in the, quote, Marxist space empire element. The following year, then, they approached director Rennie Harlan to direct, based on his work in Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. Harlan wanted to go in a whole different direction from the first two movies, having an interest in both visiting either the alien home planet or have the aliens invade Earth. Gibson's script was mockingly summed up by him as, quote, space commies hijack alien eggs, big problem in mall world, end quote. Gibson turns in his script. It was very action-oriented, so I'm told, featuring a big cast, you know, these kind of big movies. Some people have read it, consider it much better than the final Alien 3 that came out, but the producers were not too interested. David Giler said it was a perfectly executed script that wasn't all that interesting, particularly for not taking new directions with the franchise. So Gibson was out. Harlan, I guess, was on at the moment. He suggested a screenwriter named Eric Red, who wrote The Hitcher and Near Dark. 2 months later, he delivered a draft, which led him to describe Alien 3 as the one script I completely disown because it was not, quote, my script. It was the rushed product of too many story conferences and interference with no time to write and turned out utter crap. His approach had a completely new set of characters and subplots while also introducing a new breed of the alien. The plot opened with a team of Special Forces Marines boarding the Sulaco and finding that all survivors had fallen victim to the aliens. Afterwards, it moved into a small-town USA city in a type of biodome in space, culminating in an all-out battle with the townsfolk facing hordes of alien warriors. That they rejected that script, that it was deviating too much from this two-movie story that they wanted. And then at that point, they gave up on developing two movies at the same time. So then they gave it to David Twohey. He was told to start with Gibson's script. He changed the setting to a prison planet, which is the beginnings of now where how we're getting to Alien 3, which is being used for illegal experiments on the aliens. Rennie Harlan felt that this approach was way too similar to the previous movies, and so he bailed. Twohey's script was delivered to Fox, and they didn't like the idea of Ripley being taken out, declaring that Weaver is the centerpiece of the series, and Ripley was, quote, the only female warrior we have in our movie mythology. Weaver was then called with a reported $5 million salary plus a share of box office. She also requested the story to be suitably impressive, original, and non-dependent on guns. Twohey duly set about writing Ripley into his screenplay. So then we start getting closer. Walter Hill attended a screening of The Navigator, A Medieval Odyssey, which was this time travel movie directed by this guy Vincent Ward. They tried to get him on board two, three calls. On the third call, he finally accepted. He thought Twohey's script was awful, and so he had another idea involving Ripley's escape pod crash landing on a monastery-like satellite. He developed this pitch on the flight to Los Angeles. He got his idea approved by the studio and was hired on the spot to direct Alien 3. His idea was that the planet would be like this wooden planet or a wooden satellite where these monks lived. Very interesting notion. But as a woman enters their monastery, as the ship crashes into their satellite, there's all this notions of, is this woman sent by Satan to cause sexual temptation? So there's a lot of religious overtones in what I'm reading is this version of the script. And Ripley's character was about sort of her soul searching. She is seated with the alien inside of her in this one as well. And she sacrifices herself to kill the alien. So very simple. So we're getting pretty close. And Sigourney Weaver said she's only going to do the movie if Ripley dies in the third one. The production crew was very divisive about it. Walter Hill and David Gallo then did a first draft with all the stuff, putting everyone's ideas together and trying to get this to be something. And then Ward at some point realized they weren't going with his wooden planet and they wanted him to make all these changes and the script was being pulled away from him, so he bailed. At this point, sets were being built, money was being spent already on kind of Ward's vision. It's at that point they approached Fincher to replace Ward. So at this point, Fincher takes the screenplay with this author Rex Pickett, who was fired eventually, but he revised most of it done by all the previous authors. Fincher had very little time to prepare, and it was a nightmare experience. He's pretty much disowned this film in terms of his film oeuvre. He doesn't even talk about it. And then she's rewriting the script while he was shooting. The studio executives were at work blocking him big time because this was his first feature. He'd only done music videos and commercials up till now is his first feature. So he was pretty much handcuffed from the beginning. I'm going to talk about this movie, but I did that lengthy intro because I kind of just want this podcast is I really want you to get a sense of what turned up on the screen at Alien 3 was not something that I liked very much. I'm not really hacking on Fincher very much because he didn't have a chance. The guy didn't have a chance. For the most part, he was shot in the foot from the beginning, and this film was a perfect example of, 18 chefs in the kitchen arguing over what to put in the pot. So anyway, so with that, let me get to the movie itself. So we open, as we did with the previous film, tracking the USS Sulaco. So now we get an enormous amount of information during the credits. As we're being shown the credits, the camera's cutting back and forth to things that are taking place in the hibernation chamber on the Sulaco. So we get first the sleeping faces of Hicks, Newt and Ripley, then an opened alien egg. We see a crawling facehugger looming over Newt. The crack of glass in Newt's sleeper, acid eating into a part of the ship, someone's stasis being interrupted, a face hugger on X-ray on someone, we don't know who, a chestburster scream at some point, blood on someone's chest, which we don't see. Then we see the whole cryo sleep chamber area being ejected out somewhere from the Sulaco. So, lot going on in that credit sequence. So post-credits, we follow this life pod as it falls into the gravity well of this planet, which they name on screen. It's called Fiorina, quote, Fury 161, and it's called an Outer Veil Mineral Ore Refinery Double Y Chromosome Work Correctional Facility. You know, fancy sci-fi words for it's a men's prison. And we see from a distance, you know, nice widescreen shot, the hibernation unit crash into the water. So we start out with a group of people entering, and we see Hicks and Newt are dead. We see their mangled, bloody bodies. We don't know what they've died from, but we know they're dead. My first rant, my first, you know, thing that I disliked about this movie is that you have followed in Aliens, right? The characters of Newt and of Hicks fought through basically hell to get to safety, and Ripley finally saved both their asses at the end, you know, defeating the Queen. They have gone through hell and back. And here in the beginning of this film, they are unceremoniously killed off. To me, it betrays the entire franchise from the beginning, that they're just dead. And the only way that this could be, you know, in my mind, as I'm watching this film, the only way I'd be okay with it is if their deaths kind of mattered in a way in the story that made sense, that I saw the necessity for killing them off served the greater part of the story or served to deliver up a really powerful and gritty Alien 3, right? As I'll go along, I don't believe that was the case. I think that the story basically didn't include them, so they were killed off unceremoniously. And I think it was an awful idea. And I was really out of this movie from very quickly when I knew they were dead. It was quite a betrayal, actually. I've grown, you know, you grow very fond of Hicks especially, and Newt, as you've watched Aliens, and to see them just killed. So then we see Ripley on some medical table. Her clothes are being cut off. They wind up salvaging the craft by some kind of crane. And Finch is shooting really beautifully here. Like he's, you know, there's a lot of widescreen shots. You know, it feels more like Alien than Alien. It feels more like Ridley than Cameron, which is nice. You know, like there's some widescreen shots. And you can tell Finch is really kind of into his classicism here. Some of the practical effects of the film that were done kind of spoil it, because when they do these special effects of certain pieces of equipment, they kind of spoil the beautiful shots that that Fincher has set up, which is interesting. But one little tag too, as this escape craft is being lowered, we see a dog kind of barking into the open craft, and then we see a living face hugger poised to leap on the dog, and we cut away. And then we get to the prison proper, and we see it's all mostly men who have mostly English accents. We hear something about a vow of celibacy they've taken. Basically, we start off with, you know, the prison grapevine. One of the guys is sort of explaining to everybody that you know, what happened, and there's a woman that survived, so on and so forth. So, quick intro. Great set. Very vertical-ish kind of prison. Really well lit. Looks really nice. Next, we meet the doctor, Jonathan Clemons, who's played by this actor, Charles Dance, who's just one of the amazing British actors ever. He's really, really great, and I love him a lot. He's done great stuff from Bleak House on TV to being the heavy in Eddie Murphy's Golden Child, if you'll remember. So he's with Ripley. She's told about the deaths of Newt and Hicks. You know, she wants to see the ship immediately. We also hear that there's 25 men in this facility, and we'll need that number later when they start dropping. And lots of low angle shots here. Fincher likes to keep the camera low, shooting up into the sky, into people's faces. And it's kind of cool. You know, he's messing around with the camera a little bit, trying to do things very creative. And Clemons now explains how Newt and Hicks died. And we see Ripley really take it hard. I feel at least here the screenwriters are trying to do some justice to the two that Hicks and Newt are summarily killed off. And Ripley reacts as like the audience, we would react, just with, you know, she's really, really taken out by it. And it's the blow of all blows, you know, and we feel it. And also, it's what a downbeat beginning to this film. I mean, my God, just death and more death and worse to come. Ripley goes back to the ship. She sees part of Newt's chamber is, you know, some telltale melting of things, which she immediately thinks that a face hugger got in there. And then now we're cutting back and forth to the dog handler who's examining the dog, and there are strange marks on the dog's face, which, you know, we know as audience members have come from the face hugger, which has, you know, dropped its load, so to speak, and is gone. We visit Newt on a coroner's slab, and Ripley is feeling around her chest, looking into her mouth. It's just really kind of creepy. Like, Ripley has this bloody eye as well. Like, one of her eyes is really bloodshot from some contusion, which is really kind of cool. But she immediately lies to Clemens about what she's looking for. She doesn't want to tell anybody. So she demands an autopsy, right? So now we have the autopsy of little Newt. And here's why I really got angry and feel really, you know, it's, this film is very cynical. The writing and part of what Fincher does, I mean, obviously, you know, he's trying to make his bones. This is his first movie. He wants to put a lot of himself up there on the screen so he can work, you know. But he's treating the autopsy as if we're in a horror movie. And what do I mean by that? He's focusing up. He's focusing on the gleaming scalpels and all the saws. You know, we hear the sounds of things as they're breaking into Newt's chest cavity, right? Just how like sick is this? You know, we're seeing very beautifully photographed trails of blood spiraling into the drain. And to me, you know, shooting something like that is almost like, you know, you're trying to porn it up a little bit. You know, when you're shooting stuff in a very sort of sexy commercial-like way, you know, what you're missing is the import of the scene, which is poor Newt is getting cut to pieces here. And he finally breaks her chest cavity with this saw, and you hear the chest bones break. Isn't that nice? You know, like, I feel like this is such a horrible... This is how Newt ends. Cut up, sliced apart on an autopsy table. I mean, and then Fincher trying to juice it with slick photography to kind of get the audience, you know, feeling gross about it. Like, it's such an emotionally kind of devastating scene, and it's being filmed like a slick kid who wants you to kind of, I don't know, be titillated by it in some way. Go back and watch the autopsy scene again. Because it's just, it bothers me on so many levels. Coming right after we're witnessing the death of Hicks and Newt, to have this scene, it's just, it's such a downbeat, disgusting, like, I'm already out of this movie, I gotta tell you. I'm just like, this is gross. You know, they're using her as a plot device, and it's being done in this kind of horror movie-ish type of way. It's disgusting. Again, like I said, if the deaths of these two had been for something, if they mattered, if there was a reason that they died, I'd have gone along with it, you know? I'd have gone along with Hicks, with maybe Newt being injured and Hicks being alive and Hicks sort of sacrificing himself in some way. Something, you know, that gave their lives purpose. And yeah, you can say, you know, no, dude, it's hardcore. It's realistic, man. Sometimes people just die and it sucks. Like, yeah, but this isn't that kind of movie. Like, this isn't Cassavetes. This isn't a, like, you know, a French movie or a Cassavetes movie. It's a fucking sci-fi action property. So, you know, you're not going hardcore nihilism and realism on me in the third one. And especially if it's not warranted. And there's nothing in this movie to come that's going to warrant this kind of stuff. You know, they don't tease out any great themes. They're not dealing with it, to me, anything heavy enough to warrant this kind of power and this kind of harshness, you know. So, and they abuse the shit out of a dog. You know, you see a dog being kind of abused by the facehugger and the dog getting ripped apart when the thing comes out of it. It's like, ah, isn't that nice? You know, let's have an alien shoot out of a dog's stomach and, oh, gross, all of it. And not gross in a way that's cool horror movie gross, but just like, I want to take a shower after the first 15 minutes of this film. So anyway, I will soldier on. So then we meet the superintendent and his partner. I think the partner's name is Aaron. The partner's kind of comical in the scene, which I don't like because it's part of the autopsy. They allow Ripley to cremate the bodies, and they're warning her not to walk around, you know, because of the prisoners. We also cut away to the dog birthing the alien. And at that exact moment, Ripley's nose starts to bleed, which is a telltale to what's going to happen to her. When the alien's birthing out of the dog, it actually looks really good. There's a lot of this movie where the alien looks really bad and it's really boring. But in this initial chestburster incarnation, it's really good. It really looks very real. Reminded me of the chestburster alien in Alien, which was, you know, a real thing done in the camera. Then we have the very controversial, you know, Ripley shaving her head. I think she looks great, tough. And she's got a beautiful face, so it doesn't matter what you do with her hair. She can wear it. But she just, it looks good for her character, you know. She keeps being warned that she's not to mix with other prisoners. And yet, now something begins to happen to Ripley that that Weaver says is more in line with the character, but I was disappointed with. So she enters the cafeteria, and she kind of goes face-to-face with the superintendent. Like, oh, you're nervous that there's a woman on board, and does it tempt you, and so on and so forth. And yes, she's doing her Ripley, I'm not intimidated by anything. But at the same time, I don't know, there's something about it that she should be more destroyed after everything she's been through now. Not like in a place where, you know, she's doing this kind of stuff. But anyway, so Clemens fills her in on a sect, and we're not told anything about really what they believe in, that it's some version of apocalyptic Christianity. Unfortunately, they drop all of the spiritual aspects of whatever remained in the earlier script, right? Because the fact that they believe in God is such so tossed away in this film. It has nothing to do with anything that the prisoners themselves don't act in any way that's spiritual. You don't see God in their life if they believe in God. None of it matters. They're just a bunch of prisoners who are assholes. And this whole spirituality thing, I don't even know what it's still there for. I mean, they should have tossed it. Except, you know, Charles S. Dutton gets to have a few lines that are quite pithy. But and so then here's another odd thing. So we're told that the company closed the mining facility down, but these men all wanted to stay, so the company allowed it. Now, look, the Weyland-Yutani Corporation from the first two films is the most cutthroat, hardcore company you have ever imagined. There's no way they're going to spend money and send supplies to this ore processing planet when they're done there, right? I know it sounds like I'm being a prig, right? But if the film hadn't already pissed me off with what had happened up till now, I wouldn't give a shit. Like, okay, whatever. So the company's letting them stay there. But now, you know, I'm given this really kind of bullshit explanation to why they're there. So to my mind, it's like everything I've seen and heard up till now has to do with commercial economics. They weren't going to bring Hicks and Newt back, so they had to kill them off. So they just fucking killed them off, right? Then they made it squeamish with Newt on the slab. Then because it's monks in space, well, what do monks do? Monks believe in God. So we got to have them believe in God. Well, we have to explain why they're there. And so they come up with this explanation that goes against the ethos of the corporation in the first two films. Like, to me, they're batting zero here so far. I mean, none of it makes any sense to me. But like I said, if I was on board with the film in the beginning, I wouldn't be so, you know, nitpicky about stuff like that. But it's just, you know, false notes are abounding, you know, one after the other. So, and one other thing here, once we get to this part of the film, Ripley's just kind of there on the planet, you know, waiting for like the next supply ship. And I think it's a problem with a film like this, because in the first Alien film, the film starts with the distress call, so you're already on a mission. Aliens, you know, Ripley gets back, she gets busted down to a dock worker. Immediately there's a problem with the colony, and they're on a mission. So here, we've just been told a lot of really bad news, a lot of terrible things have happened for no reason that anyone can see. Then she's just there. You know, she's just there, and we'll wait. Now we're just waiting around for the alien to kind of be born and to come get them, you know. But it's like, it doesn't have much shape to it right now. And I just felt it in this moment. I was sort of like, yeah, they're just kind of waiting around, so there's going to be some bad writing while they do nothing. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that too, that I felt that, you know, that was not the best. And I think basically it just, the first two Alien films were what I call, like, the stories were essential. You were in them from the get-go. And to me, this film already feels unessential in terms of, like, it's just not, it doesn't have that same through power that the first two had. And look, you're in the franchise. You need to be telling the best story you can. So you are up against your predecessors, as amazing as they were. So now, after all this, we have another really odd, for me, an odd moment for Ripley's character, that she wants to fuck Clemens. She's like coming on to him. After hearing about the death of Hicks and the autopsy with Newt, all this death and horror and suffering. Now, what does she want to do? She's getting a little horny and wants to fuck with Clemens. And look, on one hand, this is actually explainable, that she has suffered in the first several hours of her waking up all the incredible horror and degradation of her, you know, what's going on with Hicks and Newt, right? And she wants some human connection right now, and this is the best she's going to get. Okay, you know, like, but Ripley never, ever used sex, ever. Not that, you know, women have to be chaste, right? It's not what I'm getting at, but Ripley was never one to go to that level. I don't know. This may offend some people, but it's just her character. It was just so out of character. She went from sort of vulnerable to determined in Alien, vulnerable slash tough emerging warrior, but still with a heart in Aliens. And I guess, you know, to have it, what do you do with her character at this point, right? She's gone through two really good arcs, Aliens probably being the better arc of her, you know, metaphorically and physically going back into the most frightening place that she knows and winning and conquering, you know. But so now she's like, all of a sudden now she's lost everything and she's becoming cynical. I don't know. It just struck me as not as weird for Ripley. But, you know, when I've listened to Sigourney Weaver talk about Ripley, she thinks of Ripley actually more in this vein. She has an interview where she's like, you know, one logical progression from Aliens is Ripley has a family now, right? I mean, her, Newt, and Hicks can be this family that she's fought for. And in a sense, for me, I really loved the idea that she went into the bowels of hell and came out standing and now had a family, you know? But Weaver says that to her, Ripley's character is more aloof. She's always kind of a little bit on the outside looking in, you know, willing to do what needs to be done, but never really, not a joiner, shall we say. So I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, that's Weaver's take on her. I wanted Ripley to kind of have a family after the second one, all she fought for, you know, maybe it would have been a lot trickier to find a story for that. But I don't like her like waking up, you know, watching Newt get cut open, realizing that Hicks is dead, cremating the bodies, and then, you know, having sex with this guy she just met. I don't know, it's weird. It's very weird. Not that it's, like, immoral or anything like that, but it was just an odd turn for her character for me. I will say that. The next scene, we're cutting away post-coitus, as it were. Ripley and Clemens in the morning or afterwards. You know, they have this little bit of a conversation, and, you know, I have to say Charles Dance is Weaver's equal here. I mean, holds the screen with her effortlessly because he's such a powerhouse actor. There's this barcode on his neck, which, you know, she wants to kind of get a little intimate with him now, like, hey, you know, I'll show you mine if I show you yours, but she still won't tell him about the alien, wants to know about the barcode on his neck, and he's like, you know, that's a story for another time. So then we have our first alien victim. One of the prisoners comes upon the now, you know, young ex-out-of-dog alien as it's sort of flopping around near an air vent, and thing scares him. I think it takes a piece out of him, but he falls into a cooling vent, one of a huge vent. It looks like it came out of a heavy metal music video from the 90s, actually. Some of the production design veers into that, like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome-ish kind of thing. But anyway, so he's chopped to pieces, so we got our first victim. But when Clemens goes to investigate the area, being the doctor, you know, he sees a piece of melted metal that reminds him, you know, we can tell that he's making the connection between a piece of melted metal around Newt's hibernation chamber. So, of course, as soon as Clemens tells her, Ripley's eyes pop open. Then we hear about this thing called the network, where I guess there's a network of information that bops around between certain sectors in the galaxy. That they've heard that the company now want Ripley, quote, looked after. And the superintendent is telling the doctor, because they know that they had sex, and you know, all these monks who have taken this vow of celibacy are kind of like, you know, what are you doing, buddy? You know, but the doctor's not. He didn't take that same vow. But then we have this tease about what the barcode on his neck is for. Is like, how would you like your friend Ripley and everyone else here to find out about what you did? You know, so we get this deep dark secret about Clemens that no one knows, right? Ripley wants some information about what happened to them, some information from the flight recorder. It's junked, but she's told that Bishop was thrown in on like a scrap pile and that, you know, she might be able to salvage him. So she goes out to find Bishop. You know, Finch just shoots this very well. Again, it's like a post-apocalyptic garbage pile. You know, it looks cool. And then there's this first confrontation with these inmates. The three of them get her and they're about to rape her. And then this kind of the head of the convicts, I would say, a guy named Dylan, who's played by the redoubtable Charles S. Dutton, steps in and saves her and basically tells her to leave and then winds up beating the crap out of them all with a lead pipe. And then we get our first sort of alien stalking moment. And this is the point where this is the there's a lot of this in the scenes with the alien in this film of like, we've been here before. Three prisoners walking alone, mapping some tunnels, right? With some banal dialogue between them. And they're running around in the sewers. They're lost. And, of course, the alien is stalking them. And, from what we've seen already in Alien Aliens, like, this is a lone dog alien. It's even a little smaller than the first one. So it's not really scary. And I don't really feel any sense of dread here. I'm just waiting, like, how is he going to shoot the deaths and how intense is it going to be? And they cut away, and then we get a Bishop Ripley moment. So we have a little Lance Henriksen returns, and Bishop tells her that there was a, she wants to know why the pod got ejected. You know, Bishop's basically telling her there's a fire in cryogenics. It's electrical in the subflooring. He also confirms that there was an alien on board the whole way, and that there are these sort of data squirts that the company gets automatically from all of the, they get telemetry basically from the ship. So the company knows there's a live alien on board the Sulaco and knows that there's one possibly on, on the little ship that crashed, and they want it. So she disconnects him. So then they're in this area and they bring in a guy who's like, I think two other inmates get killed. What did you see? A dragon. Ripley is doing something in the infirmary, but she has all the blinds kind of closed around her, and they're having this conversation about, quote, a dragon that killed these two inmates, and then she kind of emerges very dramatically and tells the superintendent the whole story, and of course, they don't believe her at all. But we get the little added bit here that there's absolutely no firearms and no weapons of any kind on the colony, and that anything that's going to happen will come from the next supply ship. But, we're coming from Aliens, right, where we had the state-of-the-art firepower against the colony of aliens. And, they've got basically, to use a quote from Aliens, harsh language on this one. So now Ripley starts having this cough, right? And again, this is another strange thing, because what we know when the alien nests and all this whole process takes, when you wake up, if you remember from the first film, when Kane wakes up, it's like an hour at most, and the thing comes out. Ripley has been up awake after the death of the facehugger. I mean, we're talking like a couple of days are going by here and still nothing. So we're told that it's a queen nesting in her later on. So maybe that takes a little bit longer. But again, it's another case of the writers. They need her to birth this alien, but they're hamstrung by the fact that, a few days have to go by on the colony for anything to kind of happen. And so they just delay the gestation period. And again, they're breaking with the franchise. They're breaking the rules. They're changing things. And look, I'm all for changing things if it makes sense, or if you give me a plausible explanation that makes sense in the story. None of that is given here. We don't hear any reason why she hasn't died already, So. So then we hear supposedly Clemens' deep dark story, which is supposed to make us think he was a terrible person. When he was a young doctor, he gave the wrong painkiller dose years ago and killed some people. And like, okay. He's in with these rapists and murderers and he made a mistake as a doctor. Okay, it's pretty terrible, but he's among rapists and murderers who have done like triple worse. So really strange how kind of lame it is. And then in a bizarre turn, which really, really, at this point, I was like, I'm kind of done with this movie. The alien at that point had snuck up on Ripley and Clemens as they were talking in one of the infirmary areas that has the curtains all drawn. And out of nowhere, the alien pops through the curtains and takes Clemens and kills him. And I like, first of all, he's the only interesting character of the whole bunch that I could see going all the way and maybe sacrificing himself near the end to kind of save Ripley or even surviving. He's the only interesting character. And then you pay off on his backstory about how terrible he is. I guess, are we supposed to say that this is his, this is balancing the scales? He made a mistake 7 years ago. And so for him getting caught up by the alien, I wonder if this was like a story conference, like, well, he's a really sympathetic character. And now we're just going to kill him off. There's got to be reasons for the audience to not like him at some point, so it's not so tough a death. So it feels really cheap and easy. I don't even understand it story-wise, because you've just taken away, other than Ripley, the most interesting character. And to me, it's a very cynical, and again, I think the cynicism runs through this film, and in terms of just it being a product and it dispensing with characters and just doing ruthlessly whatever it wants to do, with no real sense of wanting to adhere to the story or the spirit of the franchise that's come before. Then there's this, the famous shot that's, you know, was in the trailer where the alien's right there, Ripley's helpless, and it comes right next to her, and the second set of jaws pops out. It's beautifully shot. Like, Fincher really nails this one. Really great. And it doesn't kill her, of course, which, you know, we know what that means. So she runs to the mess hall to warn all the rest of the criminals who are there. They still don't believe her, and at that moment, the alien has followed her and through the ceiling kills the superintendent right there in front of them. So, you know, they have to believe her. So now we've got, which is another classic trope of the franchise, Ripley in charge. Everyone's around. No one knows how to deal with this thing. And Dylan supports her being in charge because she's the only, what they call the only officer, right? She was a warrant officer, Ripley, at one point. So they realize it's also there's no technology on the colony. One crazy inmate kind of goes off like, who the hell are you thinking you can be in charge or whatever? And there's a great Ripley moment where she doesn't even blink at the guy, which is great, how tough she is. Here they are. They're looking over floor plans. It seems very similar to Aliens. You know, she's looking around. Can we block off this junction and do this? Like, we've been here before, you know. So they're going to use this toxic substance to coat all these shafts with this flammable liquid. And then when the alien gets stuck in there, you know, kind of toast it. Now we're seeing Pete Postlethwaite playing one of the inmates, who's kind of wasted in this film, as almost everybody is, really. So many really good, solid English actors in this movie, but if they only had a script, you know, it would have been something. There's this plan. The alien attacks someone who's kind of still putting the coating on. And, of course, the sort of spark stick that he's using ignites the thing prematurely and everything goes up in flames. You know, flames. The effects are kind of boring. I don't find them very interesting. So the sprinklers do come on. It's kind of a... Fisher kind of gives us a pretty shot, but the slow motion and steam, you know, kind of music video-ish, as it were. But it's kind of cool. We find that the 10 of the men are killed, you know, so the fire took down most of them. Ripley now getting more sick, obviously in preparation for the chestburster. You know, and there's just a lot of the inmates are running around, we're screwed, man, we're dead, you know. And this is the moment where I feel like you could have used the faith angle to show that these inmates have some dignity, that they've come, that this their belief in God is in their lives in some way, and that, you know, the alien is just this demon to be fought, but they have to be convinced to fight all the time, you know. And it's like, why even introduce the fact that they're monks? Why can't it just be an alien prison? So I don't know. It's like, shut up. There's a lot of shut ups, you know. Like, Dylan's always telling people to shut up. Shut up, damn it. No, you shut up, you know. And so I just think the whole spiritual aspect was wasted here. I think it could have been put to great use to have these dignified prisoners, you know, showing that they're really not afraid to die, or, I don't know, something, you know. So then we get a clock. We have a rescue team is going to be there in 10 hours. Ripley at one point, because she feels so bad, grabs this guy Aaron, who is the super second, sort of second in command. She goes back to the ship that crashed. He needs her help, and so she does a med scan. He's looking at the results, and he's like, foreign tissue is there, and you can actually see a little chest burster nestling in her chest. I think there's one. You've got one inside of you. Nice scene between the two of them, actually. This isn't bad. This actor's pretty good, and there's a little bit of character here. But again, for me, character-wise, I thought, what a horrible way for Ripley to die, you know, that alien inside of her, you know? And if you wanted to go that route, you have to do more than what you're doing in this movie. So just, again, the cynicism and the downbeatness of everything that's going on here, like, ugh. She's like, you know, you've got to warn them that this thing is here. You got to send this message. And only this Aaron can send these messages, and he refuses because he's kind of he's touting the company line that they want to come here and so on and so forth, and he won't send the message. So, but we don't realize it, and off screen to both those characters, that the readout that was just done has been beamed to the company. And they're actually going to be there in 2 hours. So they've like hustled up some super fast ship somehow. And we cut to a military cruiser that looks a lot like the Sulaco briefly, and then back to Ripley in an empty part of the station. So there's this now the scene where she's going after the alien because she realizes it's not going to kill her. She's kind of invulnerable. But, you know, there's still, to me, it's like the thing could cocoon her. You know, like we know how the alien, see, when you're messing with continuity, you know, if I was the alien, like, you grab Ripley and you cocoon her in that resin so she doesn't go anywhere and she's safe and your queen can birth, and then you just kill off the inmates at your leisure. So it doesn't make sense, but again, the script needs her to kind of walk into the alien's den so the audience gets excited. There's a lot of false scares. There's roaches in one of them. She winds up backing into the alien, but again, we've seen that at the end of Alien, the first film. Then we're told that there's a queen inside her. I don't know how Ripley knows this, because the chest burster looks the same as all the rest, but she does. And she goes up to Dylan. She's like, "You got to kill me," you know. And they drag this thing out, but Dylan's like, "You know, I'm not going to kill you yet. I need you to kill this thing. And as soon as we do, I'll kill you." Dylan, even played by the great Charles S. Dutton, is still unsympathetic. You know, he's still kind of a douche. So Dylan has a great moment in the end. But anyway, so that's the story. And Ripley tells all of them, you know, they're all kind of like, "Well, we'll wait for rescue. So there's this moment where, you know, her and Dylan walk into this wonderful set. Again, the beautiful sets in this film. And they tell the guys, like, "We got to go and kill this thing now." And all the inmates are like, "Why don't we just hole up and wait for the rescue team, right?" And so Ripley's like, "They're probably going to kill you too. And anyone who's seen or knows about this thing, you know, you're expendable." And explains that, you know, they were expendable on the last mission, expendable on the first mission, which is cool. Dutton has this very brief couple of lines where he's like, "Nobody ever gave me nothing, but I say we kill this damn thing." You know, it's really good. Kind of rousing. So he kind of saves the scene, I think. Then you have this whole thing where, you know, of course, there's a mining colony, so there's molten lead, right? So a new visual, which I think Fincher's very clever to go for this. Like, the camera goes into like a fisheye lens when you're at the alien point of view. That's interesting, because the alien itself in these scenes, the CGI is pretty bad, if it even is CGI. It's not an effect in the screen on a lot of it. There's just kind of like a special effect, as it were, that looks very fake, because things do look kind of real and kind of gritty. You know, Fincher does a great job with the production design. It made me think, it's funny that the first film, in terms of effects and looking great, the first film holds up the best, then Aliens, and then this one. Now, this one, you know, made later, but they were getting into that thing where they thought they could get away cheap from having to do effects on set and doing everything in post, but they didn't have the technology that they have now, so it doesn't look that great. It's like Return of the Jedi was something very similar. So then a quick cut, the company crew arrives, guys with weapons, you know, we see this one mysterious man that's got a scarf around his face, we don't know who he is. So then at one point during this whole chase, Ripley's dragging the alien by its tail, you know, they're trying to flush it out by, you know, each of the inmates is becoming bait. And they're closing all these doors and opening all these doors to get it to the place where they're going to dump lead on it. And the editing to me is not that great, because I can't really sense what's going on and where they are. And they finally get it into this is another really scene that made no sense to me. They finally get it into the place where they're going to dump the molten lead on it. And Ripley's like, "I'm just going to stay in here with it, kill us both." And Dutton's like, "No, it dies first," in some bizarre, you know what I mean? And it's like, so you're setting up some other special ending, and it's just, it's dumb. But he dies, unfortunately. He distracts it by staying down there, and then it kills it. And then they do a little tension. They really, really delay the lead coming down. Then it's poured, and we get the wonderful music that we think it's over, but if it's an alien movie, right? So there's always a false ending. So it comes ripping out of this thing, but it's really hot. And Ripley has the great idea to pour water on it and, you know, change the temperature of it. So I think Aaron is up there and someone else is up there, and then they pour water on it, and the change in temperature, the whole thing explodes. And you know it's dead, like it's a good death scene. Ripley's kind of out over the pit, and then we see Lance Hendrickson, for real, who says he's the human designer for Bishop, but he's actually just another Bishop android, and that's confirmed in the Aliens Colonial Marines video game, which I did not play, but I read about. So it is bullshit. The company was lying that that guy who designed Bishop is long dead, and this is just another android. So, you know, there's a whole deal here. We've got a surgical bay on our ship. I can take it out of you and save your life. Aaron comes behind him and hits and knocks him down, and the guys around him are killed. And then there's her death scene, right, where, you know, there's a very long, slow fall, and there's elegiac music, and just as she's about to go into the lead, the chest burster comes out, and she grabs it, and I don't know. Say what you want about that scene. I know I have a friend of mine who really thinks it's a beautiful scene. And by itself, sure. You know, I mean, this is the end of Ripley, and she dies taking what should be the very last alien. So much has gone wrong on the screen in this film up till that I don't really think the film has earned that death, you know, at all. So we end Alien 3. So, you know, I've already ranted about the Hicks and Newt stuff. I've ranted about the autopsy. I've ranted about kind of how cynical I think things are. One of the problems I also found is that we have a sympathy problem with the human beings in this film, and that, you know, we care about the crew of, you know, the Nostromo in the first Alien movie. They're kind of quirky truckers in space, but we like them and we don't want them to die. We really love the Marines and aliens and we don't want them to die. But now we're faced with a group of prisoners who, again, if they had played up the spiritual angle, maybe we would have really respected their humility and how they've grown in terms of being in prison and whatever. But we don't give a shit. They're all assholes, all of them, except for the most sympathetic character, for the most part, who's Clemens, who's killed off. And then Aaron becomes kind of sympathetic, but it just doesn't matter. You know, like, I don't care if any of these prisoners die. And so maybe Fincher with the fisheye lens wants to kind of like do this game with the audience. Like, you want to be the alien. You want to kill these criminals. I don't know. But you don't care when they die. There has no, their deaths have no meaning, you know. When Hudson died, when Drake died, when Vasquez died in Aliens, fucking A, it mattered. It sucked. Even Gorman. Gorman has this wonderful arc, and when he dies, it is a, you know, he dies for a purpose, and it's great. And also, you know, I think what a problem here is, you know, the first film introduces everything, and you're marveling at every scene. The second movie escalates, so you have the queen is actually a new kind of alien, and it can do some crazy things. It can detach from its egg sac, you know, it's very powerful. It has this great head bone thing that really makes it look like a, you know, an alien elk, right? In the second film, it's escalation. So you've got numbers. So the humans have firepower, but the aliens are, there's more of them, you know? So you've got multiple aliens and a lot of the, you know, the blood, acid for blood. But now in the third film, we go back to just a single alien that comes out of a dog. So it's smaller and, you know, I don't know. It's just, in a sense, you know, I know the tricky thing with sequels is you always have to keep escalating and escalating, but okay, you know, you have millions of dollars and you're willing to, you're going to make this movie. It's kind of what has to happen. Something different has to occur or something unique has to be thought of. And just to have a dog alien running around, one single one, I don't know, I was really bored. I found out later, and again, why I give Fincher a pass on this movie, like I'm anybody to give David Fincher a pass, right? I'm just saying it that way. But anyway, for whatever reason, the studios really needed this movie to do well because they were in financial trouble. So they all peed in the soup, basically, and Fincher was handcuffed. He had no script in pre-production. He wanted, you know, a lot of stuff that they didn't do. He got the shaved heads, which they relented to, the barcodes in the neck, which they gave into. But I think he wanted to make a lot of changes, and they took it out of his hands. So I also heard that in the editing room, he was basically booted out, and they finished the film without him. You know, that's the story. But so there's this assembly cut now, which, again, Fincher has nothing to do with, which includes 37 minutes more of new and alternate footage. It comes in that 9-disc quadrilogy box set, which came out in 2003. And I think the Blu-ray set, which came out in 2010. It's got all this stuff with all these extra plot elements. I haven't seen it because, to me, the film's a turd in basic fundamental ways that I don't think any extended scenes are going to help. But, you know, if you're out there and you think the extended scenes save this movie, you know, drop a line and tell me why. Let me know. I'd love to hear. But Fincher was in no way participant in any of the later stuff that came on down the line. So anyway, so that's my take on Alien 3. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is Patreon. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.